Bert Cohen here. We are keeping democracy alive.
Check for pulse.
Stand clear. Push to shock.
So, yes, there's a huge gap between public opinion and public policy. That people don't feel that they can do very much.
You know what this is? This is a very Hamiltonian system. Alexander Hamilton being the guy here in a very un-Jeffersonian.
In the case of the Republicans, it's dramatically the opposite. But even in the case of the Democrats.
An absolute typhoon of terror against African Americans in the South.
America's fascists are those people who think that Wall Street comes first and the American people come second.
Really seen as a financial sector that's gotten out of hand.
The shooting, the violence, that is not the drug problem. That is, in fact, the drug policy problem.
I speak tonight for the dignity of man.
Back when Democrats were Democrats. In some ways, it's the same as it ever was. Democrats are focused on the November election. Republicans are in power. And the usual sources of Democratic money are starting to line up behind what are thought to be safe candidates, ones that certainly do not even threaten to rock the boat. As our guest today, D.D. Guttenplan, writes, all this so-called pragmatism comes from the assumption that the parameters of practical politics are already fixed and as narrow as this space separating Andrew Cuomo from Chuck Schumer. Well, amazingly enough, that space is being filled again by, I read in today's New York Times that Hillary Clinton is getting out there campaigning for Andrew Cuomo and others, as if she thinks that approach can work when it didn't work in 2016. It's amazing to me. Is 2018 going to be just more of the same? Well, I don't know about you, but when I hear people talk about a coming blue wave, I worry. The traditional comfort in knowing that in off-year elections, the out-of-power party always makes gains really concerns me. Such thinking leads to complacency, which leads to failure. Our guest asks, what if the election of Donald Trump represents not merely a rightward swing of the pendulum requiring Democrats to do little more than wait for the inevitable counterstroke, but a wrecking ball to politics as usual? What if the shape of the electorate is changing, making a win by the kind of left populist coalition the Bernie Sanders campaign had a real possibility? End of quote. What happens if the traditional money power centers within the Democratic Party get it wrong yet again? And what happens if we let them get it wrong yet again? Well, it is no exaggeration to say that the future of democracy itself is at historic risk in this upcoming election. These Trump Republicans are out to complete the transition from a Republican form of government, small r Republican form of government, to an authoritarian plutocracy, a transition which has already achieved great success. What if the election ahead is about more than shifting back and forth between two top-heavy, heavily moneyed political parties, and instead is about the actual locus of power? Where is the power? Is it with the top or is it with the people? There's been a steady erosion of citizens' belief in our own legitimate power, as we can all tell. There has been an intentional trend to convince Americans we're powerless. We may as well just give up. But since the shockwave of the election and installation of President Donald Trump, it's been something that we really are starting to wake up about, that we are not powerless. As the Jefferson Airplane's Paul Kantner saying, something's happening in America. People across the country are angry that the power, which in a democracy is supposed to rest with the citizens, has been assaulted. So how to win in November is the immediate question. Win power away from the distant forces of big corporate money in both parties, which have had their thumb on the electoral scales for a long time. It was this money which pushed so hard against Bernie Sanders to ensure the Democrats' horse in 2016 race would be the centrist Hillary Clinton. Now, as Democrats are still licking their wounds, there is tension within the party. To come up with the best research, our guests spent some time in one of the reddest of red states, Texas. The title of Guttenplan's article in The Nation is Texas Showdown, Inside the Battle for the Democratic Party. It's subtitled, Insurgent Populists Are Facing Off Against Establishment Picks in a Series of High-Stakes Runoffs. Perhaps summing it up best in the article is one of the insurgent candidates, Laura Moser, who's running for Congress in Texas' 7th District. She says, we've tried something over and over in Texas politics, which is to run to the middle and to the right, and it's not working. Could 2018 really be different? Might the old style, so-called safe candidates be insufficient to the task ahead when it really is a question of power? D.D. Guttenplan is the nation's editor-at-large. His book, American Radical, The Life and Times of I.F. Stone, great American, was awarded the Sperber Prize for Biography. Don also produced the acclaimed documentary Edward Said, The Last Interview, and wrote and presented War, Lies, and Audio Tape, a radio documentary about the Vietnam War for the BBC. His latest book, The Nation, a Biography, is available in print or as an ebook. Don, thanks so much for being with us on Keeping Democracy Alive.
It's great to be here, Bert.
I assume you do not live in Texas. What prompted you to hit the ground?
I'm coming at you from rainy Guilford, Vermont at the moment.
Ah, Guilford, Vermont, yes. What prompted you to hit the ground in the ever-so-red Lone Star State? What was your purpose? Why Texas?
Well, I have a bunch of people, as most reporters do, who I talk to from time to time to take soundings. I mean, it's a pleasure to be here being grilled by you, since it's usually the other way around. You're one of those people. And others have told me that what was happening in Texas was worth paying attention to, specifically that there's a kind of a crop of left-wing populists, Bernie-crats, call them whatever you like. I mean, most of them had some either support or involvement in the Sanders campaign, but not all of them. And they're running for office in Texas. And not surprisingly, but dismayingly, the Democratic Party is doing everything it can to thwart them from getting elected.
Wow.
And so I decided to go down there and take a look. The first person who was on my radar was Laura Moser, because she got monstered by the DCCC. She was running in a primary against six other opponents, one other woman, and the DCCC came in and released a whole opposition dossier that they'd collected on her to try and knock her out of the race. That backfired and helped her fundraising, and she made it through to the runoff, but it's still a tough fight. And when I decided to go down and look at her, of course, The Nation, as your listeners may or may not know, is not a wealthy magazine, so I figured I'd better get bang for the buck.
Yeah.
And I found a few more races where there are these populist insurgent candidates challenging centrist Democrats. The thing is that the Democratic Party establishment has its ideal profile for a candidate in a flippable district.
Mm.
And that profile is ideally ex-military or ex-CIA or ex-intelligence agency, and even better if they're a former Republican. And the only other thing that they really care about is, can they raise a whole lot of money?
Right.
So you get a bunch of people running who are not committed to health care for all or Medicare for all. You get a bunch of people who are running who are all over the place on Donald Trump's deportation plans. And, of course, in Texas, that's a big issue. And you get a lot of people running who think that the current economic arrangement in the United States works just fine.
Yeah, true.
And, you know, those are the kinds of people that have run and lost for Democrats for a couple of decades now, and I was interested in seeing whether people who were offering a different kind of choice, how they fare.
Boy, it's certainly true. The centers of power have not shifted, really. The people who have been left out by the current version of the Democratic Party, which was kind of changed very much in the 1990s with the rise, and not everybody knows this, of the Democratic Leadership Council, which figured, well, the big corporations, the super wealthy people have all the money. Let's just go to them. And they turned their back on the average working people. And I think average working people are starting to wake up. And you tell a number of interesting stories in different congressional districts in Texas. There appear to be similar threads in all of them. You start with the story of Rick Trevino. You say he's not just running for Congress from the 23rd Congressional District. He's on a mission. Tell us about that mission and what he's up against and how it's going for candidate Rick Trevino.
Well, Rick Trevino is a great story, and we'll find out soon how he does in the runoff. But he was a high school history teacher who got involved in Democratic politics essentially because he saw Bernie Sanders ranting about tied cost of living. It was a sort of a recalculation of benefits that the Obama administration proposed, and that Bernie was one of the few senators to oppose at the time. But his mother's an immigrant from Mexico. His father's of Mexican origin, but born in the U.S. He was born in Laredo and went back and forth between Laredo and Nuevo Laredo all his childhood. Became a high school history teacher in San Antonio. Had two of his students gunned down in, you know, drive-by shootings where they were bystanders.
Oh, my.
And in a sense, that made him politically active. And then when he started to get into the Democratic Party, in his area, he realized it was a kind of well-run machine for managing expectations rather than delivering actual change. And so he decided to run in the 23rd Congressional District, which is one of the most flippable districts in the country. It's gone back and forth between Democrats and Republicans. The current incumbent, Will Hurd, is one of the few black Republicans in Congress, a former CIA officer. But in the primary, Rick was running against a candidate who was anointed and assisted by the Castro brothers, Joaquin and Julian Castro, who kind of run Latino politics in San Antonio. And they raised hundreds of thousands of dollars for their anointed candidate, and Rick cashed in his pension and his benefits.
Oh my.
Raised about $19,000 of his own money and managed to raise about $10,000-$12,000 in donations, and essentially ran his campaign out of the back of his car. But what he would do is he would go to places, these colonias, which are these, essentially colonias is means colony, and they're sure. Like these little third world towns on the border, which have no municipal services. Often they have no paved roads, and they have tens of thousands of American citizens living in third world conditions. And Rick would show up, and he'd say, you know, I'm running for Congress, and I'd like to change things. And he'd talk to people. It was very much a retail strategy, and yet when the votes were counted on primary day, having spent about $3 a vote, he came in second, whereas the Castro brothers candidate, having spent in excess of $50 a vote, came in fourth. So he's through to the runoff. He said to me, I'm not a liberal, I'm a radical. He's definitely an interesting guy, very committed. I would say that whether he gets through this time or not, we will hear more from Rick Trevino. The other race I mentioned is Laura Moser versus Lizzie Pinnell Fletcher. That's the 7th district. That's essentially a wealthy suburb of Houston. It was the district that first sent George H.W. Bush to Congress in the 60s, and it's been Republican ever since, but Hillary Clinton carried it by 1% in 2016, so it's definitely on the Democrats' map as a target district.
And so, as you write on this campaign, Fletcher's running a campaign, Moser is building a movement. Now, that sounds inspiring, but the goal for now is to actually win the seat in Congress this November. Is this, you know, sometimes I wonder about building a movement, which is not what the mainstream of the Democratic Party wants to do. They don't want to build a movement. They want more of the same. How ready are people for change? It does seem that every year people either want more of the same or change. In 2016, clearly they wanted change, and they got change all right. But how is it going for Moser, for Laura Moser in the 7th district?
Well, look, I have to be honest with you. I mean, all the three districts I wrote about are uphill fights. They're either uphill fights in terms of money, which is definitely the case in Rick Trevino, where he's, you know, trying to raise enough money even just to get on Latino radio. On the other hand, he's the only Latino candidate in a district that's 65% Latino, so,
wow.
You know, he might have a chance. In Laura Moser's district, her opponent's been endorsed by Emily's List, and in that kind of, you know, educated suburb, that counts for a lot, as well as being endorsed by the DCCC, which helps her raise a lot of money. And I guess, you know, in 2016, people clearly wanted change, but the Democrats were offering more of the same.
Exactly.
So the only door to change was the door on the right.
That's right.
And what these candidates are trying to do is push open a door to change on the left, which the Democratic Party seems to be trying to wedge shut as best as it can. And, you know, one of the things that we'll find out in Texas is whether we're strong enough to push that door open. We may not be. And I suppose, you know, if you're, even if you don't want more of the same, if you want change but you think that the way to get change is to run down the center, well, you know, that may be the strategy that works in 2018, and if it does work, we have to face it.
Yeah.
But I think in the long run, that's only a recipe for more of the same. So if it doesn't, if these candidates don't win this time, it definitely has to be on us to try harder next time. And I don't think people should be under any illusion that it's going to be easy. I mean, Bernie used to talk about a rigged system, and you can't talk about a rigged system and then complain that you're not getting a fair shot. Of course you're not getting a fair shot. That's what a rigged system means.
Ah, good point. If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. We're all part of that. And our guest today is Don Guttenplan, who writes for The Nation. His current article is Texas Showdown, Inside the Battle for the Democratic Party, subtitled Insurgent Populists Are Facing Off Against Establishment Picks in a Series of High-Stakes Runoffs. People have asked me, I mean, I stick with the Democratic Party. It seems to me going third party guaranteed to help the Republicans. There is no Green Party. There is, you know, you have to try to take over the party from the inside, I do believe. I've heard it suggested, and I wonder, you may have some insight in this, as to whether the Washington Democrats, the DNC, the DCCC, do they want to win, or is it just about, I mean, they're sitting on top of the gravy train right now, making money. There's all these, you know, special consultants who are doing really well. Sometimes I wonder, do they really want to win, or is it just, I hate to think that they'd be just in it for, you know, keeping their own power and money source going. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, of course they want to win, but they define winning differently than we do. They define winning either by getting a Democratic majority under any definition of Democratic majority in Congress, which means that you may get a situation like Obama had in his first term, where he had a Democratic majority, but any significant change that he wanted to do, whether it was health care or anything else, was blocked by, you know, these DINOs, these Democrats in name only,
right,
who essentially voted with the Republicans on the issues that threaten the oligarchy. We define winning as fundamental change, as giving people a real social democratic safety net so that they don't have to live in fear that if their kid gets sick, they're going to lose their house. We define winning as an educational system in which people get to go to college if they are qualified to benefit from college and not based on what kind of jobs their parents do or how much their parents make. And in order to get that kind of change, you sometimes have to be prepared not to win every round. I mean, that seems to me the main lesson that the left has to learn from the Tea Party, is that if the Tea Party listened to the Republican centrists who said, you know, we're going to lose this district. If you run against Eric Cantor, you're just going to open the possibility of a Democrat winning. If you run against this person, you're going to open the possibility for a Democrat winning. Well, that happened in a few districts.
Sure did.
But, you know, they stuck to their guns and eventually brought their party with them. The left seems to have trouble doing that. And part of it is because we're always listening to the siren song of, you know, settling for the status quo as long as the status quo has a D behind next to its name.
And there's their subject of fear. An old friend of mine, a former Unitarian minister, said there's only two things that motivate people in politics: fear and reassurance. And I wonder now, you know, is the fear level turned up enough so that, you know, people are not I mean, I see young people are not afraid of the word socialism. It used to be the case that people hear the word socialism and they stop thinking. The word radical, you use the word radical. I wonder if now might be a time. I mean, the Democratic status quo hates that kind of talk. I mean, it just makes them run for the hills. They're terribly frightened of the term socialist or radical. But certainly what we have in there now is radical to the right. I mean, just extreme radical. What's your sense from talking to people in red Texas about things like, you know, the terms radical and socialist? Does it motivate people?
I mean, you know, there is a DSA chapter in Texas. There are several, and they're active, but they're a tiny minority. I mean, I don't think most Texans are ready to talk socialism, but I think most Texans, and this is what makes all three of these candidates possible, most Texans, and there's hard polling data to back this up, most Texans are in favor of Medicare for all. Most Texans are in favor of health care that isn't rationed by wealth. Most Texans are in favor of free state and community college. And most Texans are actually in favor of sensible gun control, although you would never know it from the national media. So, you know, I think if you go in with these delusions that all you have to do is enlighten the yahoos about the virtues of revolution, we're never going to get
there. Yeah, that's for sure.
On the other hand, it's interesting what your friend said about fear and reassurance. Personally, I think the fear levels in the United States are cranked up to 11 right now, and don't need to be cranked up anymore.
No.
But what the Democrats didn't offer in 2016 was any real reassurance to people who were suffering that their lives would be better if they voted for a Democrat. Whereas they got a sense, now this may have been a fraudulent sense, but they got a sense from Donald Trump that their lives would be different if they voted for him.
Yep.
So, you know, in the election of change versus stasis, change definitely won.
Yes.
But, you know, as I said, we only offered change in one direction. If the Democrats offer real change, then they may well be successful. And one of the things we'll see if these candidates get through to the general election is whether that's the case. But they've got to get through the runoff first. And you know, as I said, the odds are against them. It's an uphill fight in every one of these cases. The one who I think if you were a betting person has the best chance is actually the one we haven't talked about yet, and that's Mary Wilson. She's in Texas 21. And what was interesting about her was that was a race where you had a left labor candidate endorsed by Our Revolution. You had a centrist candidate backed by the DCCC with lots of money. Joe Copser, who's a former Republican, who has compared the Mexican-U.S. border to the Iraq-Iran border. But because he's a former intelligence officer and a former Republican, you know, the Democratic establishment love him. He's been able to raise lots of money.
Yeah.
And then there were five people in the race or four people in the race, and in every press account I read, it would say, and then there was the fourth candidate, Mary Wilson, and they'd say almost nothing about her except maybe they'd say she was a minister. So she turns out to be the first lesbian Baptist minister in the state of Texas, and her policies were pretty much identical to the Labor Our Revolution candidate, and in fact he has now endorsed her. But interestingly, in the primary, where, again, she raised a little over $2.50 a vote, she spent a little over $2.50 a vote, and Copser spent about $50 a vote, she won. She actually came in first.
Wow.
And I asked her about that, and she said to me that part of it, no doubt, had to do with being the only woman in the race in the kind of year of women running, although it's interesting to note that she's was the only woman in the race. She's, you know, forthrightly pro-choice, and yet Emily's List still hasn't endorsed her. So there are some questions about that for them to answer. But like I said, she came in first, and now that she came in, when she came in first in the primary, it meant that it made it much easier for her to raise money.
Right.
So and also the other thing about her is that because she's a minister, and this is something that the Democrats don't really, or I would say the left doesn't pay as much attention to as we really need to, which is that she had a base. She had a strong institutional connection to her congregation. And, you know, that meant that she didn't start out just one person who liked the sound of their own voice. She was somebody who brought other people with her to the table and indeed to the voting booth. And so if she gets into the general election, I think that'll be a really interesting race, because she's running in the district that used to be represented by the worst climate denier in Congress.
And who was that?
I knew you were going to ask me that.
And you forgot. It's all right.
I'm terrible at remembering names.
But her name is...
In case he's retired, so the Republicans now have an open seat.
Right. Well, that's kind of hopeful, an open seat there. And we're talking about Mary Wilson. You know, I've gotten on... My email just is filled up with requests for money. And I got some from Cosper, but not... I hadn't heard of Mary Wilson until I read this article. But that's one of the beautiful things about it. And talk about... You know, building base. Moser, you say that Laura Moser is expanding the progressive base of the Democratic Party. I wonder if that's something the traditional insiders would rather not be bothered with. I mean, you know...
She's not just expanding the base of the Democratic Party. She's using distributed organizing.
Sure.
Which is the technique that the Sanders people used in the states where they didn't have national staff, where essentially they would send somebody down to train people, and then they would leave and say, right, you run the state because we don't have enough people to run this state.
Right.
And interestingly, those were the states where Bernie did better than the states where he had a lot of national staff.
Wow.
And part of that is that when you ask people to... When you have a big ask, people are more likely to step up and deliver. And part of it is that you give people the freedom to innovate, and you give people the freedom to use the local knowledge they have.
Right.
You know, if people say, well, look, in this district, it's not about the labor unions. It's about the PTA. Or, you know, in this district, it's about environmentalism.
Mm-hmm.
People who live there tend to know which buttons people want to have pushed and which issues they want to have addressed.
And that's talking about...
But it was interesting because that was what the Dean campaign did in 2004 and enabled them to raise a lot of money. But when Obama took over that strategy, he centralized it. So he did the same kind of fundraising, but he didn't distribute authority. You know, he didn't decentralize the authority. It was a tightly controlled campaign. And I think that's something that the Democratic establishment is much more comfortable with, a tightly controlled campaign. Now, it's true that if you genuinely give people the freedom to organize themselves, they may not always do what you want, and they may not pick the issues that you like, and sometimes they may even say things that are embarrassing, and then you have to sort of, you know, figure out how to deal with that in the kind of media environment we live in. But on the other hand, if people feel that they have control and that they're running the campaign themselves, they're much more likely to work a lot harder and a lot more effectively. And so I have to say, I'm really interested to see. You know, they've made almost a million phone calls in this district. They've knocked on tens of thousands of doors. They've got 2,000 volunteers, and in a runoff election, the whole electorate's probably going to be about 10,000 people. So, you know, if each of their volunteers can bring three people with them to vote, she'll win.
So interesting, and
maybe it's time to look again at the model, but it's...
And it's about power, as you said.
That's going to be a really interesting, what labor organizers call a structure test. I think this race is going to be a really interesting structure test for the kind of insurgent left.
Interesting phrase. I can so see that, because, you know, here in New Hampshire, we know that on-the-ground stuff involving local people is the way to do it. You know, you can spend a zillion dollars on TV and radio, but listening to people, I learned a long time ago that people think you're really smart if you just listen to them. And it's about power, as you say, not just winning the election, not just blue and red and blue and red. It's about power. And this is, as you say, that's a good description, I think, a structural test. Is this a time when people recognize that, hey, what's happened to our power? I think that's one of the, it turned out to be quite false, and to many of us, we could see it was false, of the Trump campaign, that playing on the sense that people have that they feel powerless. They feel like somebody else is in charge. And I've seen a lot of campaigns in which national experts come in at the last minute and they shall we say, screw things up. People don't like it when the national experts come in and tell everybody what to do, and they have no idea what's going on the ground.
I'll tell you where they really don't like that kind of thing, and that's Texas.
Tell me more.
They really don't like it in Texas when somebody from Washington, let alone some Yankee, comes in and tells them how they ought to vote.
Yeah, well, that's what happens. And, you know, basing it on TV, I certainly remember, as do you, I'm sure, in the 2016 campaign, Hillary Clinton and the Democratic Party spent a lot of money on TV ads just displaying Donald Trump's impressive lack of decency and character. I mean, he's not a nice guy. He's kind of a real creep. But that didn't seem to matter all that much. As we move toward November, it does seem that Democrats seem to be talking about, and what they're betting on is Trump and Russia, Trump and Russia. From the streets of Texas, you know, is that connecting the campaign that Hillary did, you know, on how bad Donald Trump is, what a creep he is, didn't seem to cut it. But how about this Trump and Russia stuff? How is that playing on the ground in Texas?
I have to say, I didn't get a sense of outside the kind of people who watch Rachel Maddow every night. Anyway, it's connecting very much. But, you know, it's interesting because you could look at it two ways. I mean, one way is that the whole country's got buyer's remorse, and all people are looking for is a chance to vote against the Republican Party because of how much they hate Donald Trump.
Yeah.
And, you know, that might be true. I mean, I don't think it's true. I'd like it to be true, but I'm always suspicious of, you know, things that I'd like, wishful thinking.
So, yeah.
But let's say for a minute that it is true. What does that mean? That means that there's a huge blue wave coming, and it really doesn't matter who the Democrats nominate, because anybody they nominate is going to, you know, think of it as in a surfing analogy.
Mm-hmm.
When there's a big wave, all you need to be is be on a board and stay on your board.
Right.
And it may be that that's why the people who believe that, who tend to be the sort of Washington Democrats, they are desperately trying to push every progressive off their board.
Yeah.
So that if that wave comes along, the people who end up on the beach are people who think like them and not people who think like us. And I think that's part of what you're seeing here. Part of what you're seeing here is that the people who think that it doesn't matter who gets nominated, any Democrat can win, want to make sure that it's their kind of Democrat who gets nominated.
Right.
Now, I think that what matters is Democrats or candidates who actually reflect people's needs and their hopes and their fears and their anxieties and can relate to them.
Connect, yes.
And also who tell people the truth about what they're going to do and what they think is possible and who derive their support, including, importantly, their financial support from, you know, ordinary voters and not from PACs or from wealthy donors. And if you believe that, then you've got to take a look at, you know, who's funding the candidates and how they're being funded and how the campaigns are being run.
And the Democratic National Party was clearly very surprised at the wave, shall we say, of $27 average contributions that came in for Bernie. They had, you know, their old model, and as you talk about structure here, was, well, go after the big money. I mean, Hillary spent virtually all her time going after the big money, you know, not reaching out to working people, to labor unions, skipping a whole bunch of working class states because you figure, oh, well, who else are they going to vote for? Well, we know who they voted for. But it's this structural thing that maybe something's going on that they don't really know what it is. Well,
I think of that line from, you know, bow out of a thin man all the time. I think something's definitely happened here, and none of us know what it is.
Yes.
I don't think even Trump and his people knew what it was. I just think they benefited from it.
True, they did. And I think
played out.
Personally, I think had Bernie been the nominee, I think he would have won because he connected. He really, I don't know about other parts of the country, but around here, I talked to independents. They were like, I don't know, it's either Trump or Bernie. The populist thing. They're right-wing populist and left-wing populist. And
well, I agree with you about there being right-wing populist and left-wing populist, but it's interesting because one of the other things you're seeing, certainly in the kind of mainstream media lately, is this very strong effort to discredit the idea that there could be left-wing populists and that populism is anything other than a kind of fancy word for white nationalism.
Whoa.
And you know, first of all, that's ahistorical, since the populist, the whole populist phenomenon began in the United States in the South as a coalition between poor white farmers and poor black farmers. And secondly, it seems to me a little bit suspicious that just when you have this kind of left populist insurgency that we saw in places like New Hampshire, Iowa, Oregon, you know, states where Bernie did very well, along comes an effort to say, oh, no, that's not possible.
Yeah, but it was. It clearly was possible. And, you know, I wonder, you know, like we talked a bit about, you know, the Washington Democrats, the DCCC, and Emily's List. The DCCC, as you explain, it looks like they have decided, the Washington people have decided that voters in red states like Texas aren't ready for Medicare for all or for $15 minimum wage. They call themselves pragmatic Democrats. What do you know about that? Are people ready for Medicare for all or $15 minimum wage? They're scared of it,
well,
for sure.
You know, I think reporters have to be careful about making big claims, because no matter how hard we work, we can't be everywhere. But I can tell you that the polling data consistently shows that people are ready for, you know, some form of national health care, that people are ready for not facing bankruptcy when one of their kids or their parents gets sick. But I think, you know, that again, that's part of the conversation, which is that they want to paint us as starry-eyed idealists, whereas they are the hard-bitten pragmatists.
Right.
And
they do.
And the answer to that is that no, we are the pragmatists, because they want to keep trying something that we know doesn't work. You know, it maybe it worked great for Bill Clinton in the 1990s, the DLC approach of, you know, we need to compete with the Republicans. They have all the money, so we have to find a way to go to where the money is and get the money people to give us money.
Right, that was their whole strategy.
You know, Howard Dean showed that you don't have to do that. That doing that is a choice. Because he didn't do that, and he raised more money than Bill Clinton had raised. So from then on, we know that Democrats who rely on large donors, PACs, and corporate sugar daddies are making a choice about who their constituents are. And, you know, our argument is that you've tried it and tried it and tried it. It doesn't work. So why don't the Democrats try standing for something? Why don't they try getting a little backbone and seeing whether people respond to that?
You know, again, I don't know about other parts of the country, but backbone is what people are looking for. Hillary, I mean, what the heck did she stand for? Nobody knew. You know, people want to see some backbone. They don't have a lot of time to investigate their, you know, positions on the issues, but they want somebody to stand up for something. And my sense is the DCCC and other, you know, organizations like that are afraid of candidates with backbone because, oh, maybe they'll say the wrong thing, like Medicare for all or $15 minimum wage. I don't know. We'll find out. I guess they'll find out. But I would think maybe they would have gotten the message from 2016 that trick didn't work. I don't know. And speaking of the DCCC, they used to have a rule. They've been around a long time. They used to have a rule that they did not endorse in Democratic primaries. Now they do.
Yeah, that sounded like a really good rule to me.
Yeah.
I mean, whether you're, a radical or a centrist, I definitely am in favor of being a small D Democrat.
Yes.
Letting the voters decide who they want to represent.
Whoa,
them.
What a concept.
And it really seems deeply wrong to me for the party that is supposed to represent this, if it's going to be a broad church, you know, if we're not going to have litmus tests, if it's going to be okay to be against, for example, Medicare for All, because either you don't believe it or you don't think it can work or you don't think the voters in your district are ready for it. Well, you know, maybe you're right, but the way to test that is to enter a primary and come out and say it and run against somebody who says the opposite and see who the voters go for. Not to have somebody put their thumb on the scale with a lot of money for you and then say, oh, look, you know, this person was able to raise money, and that proves that we're not ready for Medicare for All.
Crazy. If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here, The show is Keeping Democracy Alive, and our guest today is Don Guttenplan. His article in The Nation is called Texas Showdown, Inside the Battle for the Democratic Party. Insurgent populists are facing off against establishment picks in a series of high-stakes runoffs. And again, part of the establishment has become Emily's List, which listeners to this podcast are probably pretty familiar with Emily's List. They've been staples within the pro-choice community for a long time. They only endorse women candidates, and their endorsement means a lot of money for their anointed ones. And there is a candidate, we have like 10 candidates for the first congressional district here in Little New Hampshire. They have endorsed. And there are three women pro-choice candidates, but they have endorsed one of them. My sense is that has hurt that particular candidate, that people are saying, hey, who are they to come in and tell us how to vote, who we should support? How is that playing out in Laura Moser's district? I mean, she's pro-choice, right? How is Emily's List?
Pro-choice. It's interesting because Lizzie Fletcher, who's her opponent, the one who's endorsed by Emily's List,
right,
in her campaign literature has a picture of herself, I think in high school, going to a defend, you know, a Roe v. Wade rally in 1992.
Mm-hmm.
And in the original of the picture, which has been published widely on the Internet, Laura Moser's brother Ben is standing next to Lizzie Fletcher, but she cut him out for the campaign.
Yes.
I mean, her parents, Laura Moser's parents, were both on the board of Planned Parenthood in Texas. You know, she comes from longtime supporters of women's right to choose. She has herself always been a vocal proponent of women's right to choose. Her national base comes from something called Daily Action, which was she founded after Trump won the election, and it essentially, if you subscribe to it, they text you one political concrete thing you can do every day to oppose what's happening to our country, and it has 300,000 subscribers, and a lot of the Daily Action things are about defending abortion rights. So you've got two women who on the issue of choice and on feminism, there isn't an inch between them. But Emily's List decided they were going to endorse Lizzie Fletcher essentially because they thought she could raise more money.
Right.
Well, either that or if, you know, there was a story in The Intercept by Ryan Grimm that suggested that what they were doing was essentially a favor for a big donor in Texas who was a supporter of Lizzie Fletcher's and who felt that Laura Moser should get out of the way. And, you know, that's not the way democracy is supposed to work either.
No, that sounds like what the Republicans do.
But, you know, I guess I would want to just differentiate, maybe because I'm sentimental or maybe because I'm a man, between Emily's List, which does do some good work in some places, and the DCCC, which I think should just be dissolved and is essentially a protection racket for Democratic incumbents and has no principle other than perpetuating those in power staying in power.
And I really think people are not that dumb. They see that. You know, it's fairly obvious. I mean, you see it, you're a reporter, I see it. But I think a lot of people see that you know, they just have...
I think people see it in some cases, but, you know, I have good friends in Texas who are active in Moms Demand Sense on gun regulation.
Sure.
So I talked to them about, you know, what was happening in the state and who they were supporting and who their friends were supporting, and they put me in touch with a friend of theirs who's volunteering for this woman, Lizzie Fletcher, essentially because she's endorsed by Emily's List. Mm. I mean, you know, people have busy lives, and if you regard the Emily's List endorsement as a good housekeeping seal, then and you're trying to pick it from a field of like six candidates who to work for or who to give your 20 or 40 or 50 bucks to, you know, sometimes you don't get the chance to read the fine print. So I'm not arguing that Emily's List should go out of business. I'm saying that people should read the fine print before they take Emily's List's word, particularly in a race where there are other women in the race and other pro-choice women.
Yeah, that's been very frustrating. I mean, they did endorse Hillary. After all, she was the right gender for them, but Bernie had a much better record on the issue of choice. But then again, they're about electing women. And you know, feminism, choice, issues like that. Texas has kind of a reputation of being motivated by what is called social conservatism, you know, being anti-gay, anti-choice, issues like that. By being out there on these issues, I would think the you know, the big money people might be concerned, and that they want to go for safety, and that, you know, you don't want to rock the...
Well, you know, Texas has its reputation, but first of all, remember that Cecile Richards, who was until recently the head of Planned Parenthood, she's from Texas. Her mother, Ann Richards, was the governor of Texas.
Loved her.
And, of course, the great left-wing populist Jim Hightower, who was the agriculture commissioner of Texas, and who famously said that that the only thing in the middle of the road in Texas are white lines and dead armadillos.
Right. I thought it was yellow stripes, but I same thing either way.
Well, if it's yellow stripes, he's up to date, because that's what I saw, yellow stripes. I thought it was white. Anyway,
so
my point is that, you know, Texas has had a populist tradition that goes back to the 1890s. The first populist platform, the Cleburne Demands, was written in Texas. And, of course, in the 30s and 40s, you had, you know, great congressmen like Maury Maverick from Texas, and Wright Patman. So you had, you know, there's always been a populist tradition in Texas, and it's sometimes come to power. But I think it was Ann Richards who also said that it's not that Texas is a red state, it's a blue state with a turnout problem.
Nah.
And, you know, part of that is because, and this is one of the things that I observed in every one of the districts I went to, which is that it's been exquisitely gerrymandered to really tilt the board in favor of the Republican incumbents. So they, you know, they stack and they crack. And what that means is that if you have a place like Austin or Houston, which Houston has a Democratic African-American mayor, you know, it's a town that would have it's a Democratic town. Austin, of course, is one of the most progressive cities in the country.
Oh, yeah.
So what you do is you have these pie-shaped districts where you have a tiny sliver of Houston or Austin, so it's cracked up into pieces. And then where there are too many Democrats to distribute that way, they stack them by putting even more in that district. So you get these safe seats, like the Castro brothers' seat in San Antonio, where the person's going to be elected and elected and elected. Once they're in office, they're an incumbent forever, and they're an incumbent Democrat, but of course they don't have to answer to the voters, because once they've been elected, they'll be there forever. So, you know, there are lots of ways to disenfranchise people, and they practice all of them in Texas.
Ah, they do. Well, they do that everywhere, too, that whole redistricting thing. That is such a big issue coming up after 2020, because redistricting, as you know, has help the Republicans tremendously and hurt...
Well, it helps the Republicans, but it's also a consequence of the Obama organization's inattention to state legislative races.
Interesting.
You know, if you don't care about anything below the level of the White House or maybe Congress, then what happens is you see the Democrats keep losing these state legislative races and losing these state houses that then draw lines that are favorable to Republicans.
And that whole thing, that brings up a theme that seems to be running through this discussion. You know, is it top down or bottom up? Because I think, you know, the legislatures, you know, the House and the Senate in each state, that's really important. And that local connection, you know, like what is important to local people, that really motivates people. And I think, you know, groups like the DCCC and others don't see that. They don't want to see that. And
well, it's interesting because one of the things that I saw in Texas, I mean, you know, I wrote about these three congressional campaigns because for a national publication, it's hard to get people to pay attention to anything lower down on the ticket than Congress. And because I think these are important races and really interesting candidates. But I talked to the people from Our Revolution in Texas, and while they're glad that these people are running and they have in each case endorsed them and you know, supported them as much as they can, they're not really concentrating their resources there. They're concentrating their resources on state legislative races.
Interesting.
And
smart.
And even things like, which in Texas are really important, county commissioners, agriculture commissioners, school board races, because that's really where the power comes from. The power comes from these local races. And, you know, you can elect an interesting figurehead at the top, but if he doesn't have any support further down the ticket, he or she isn't going to be able to do anything.
That is so true, I think. And we mentioned Jim Hightower, who I actually became friends with in 1976. He was working on the Fred Harris campaign, who, as you may have noticed, did not become president. but he, Jim Hightower is never at a loss for words. He said, and this is in your article, people aren't interested in incremental change. People are getting screwed. He used a different word, but this is radio.
I'm glad you advised your listeners that it was a slightly different word in the original. Yes,
indeed. Well, and Jim Hightower also declared that in rural Texas, it's not enough to be for the farmer. You've got to be against those bastards who are trying to run over the farmer. And he's always been a progressive populist. This whole, I mean, I've known populism for a long time. I mean, you know, in the late 19th century, rural farmers were at the heart of the populist movement, you know, in the Midwest, places like that. From your research, could it be said accurately that that sentiment is alive again? And if so, why?
I think that sentiment is very much alive, but I think it's changed a bit. You know, in the late 19th century, a quarter of Americans lived or worked on farms, and that, you know, that isn't true anymore.
No.
So no matter how radical farmers might get, and of course they're split, but, you know, you still have places like Minnesota, Farmer Labor Party. You still have prairie populism in Nebraska and Iowa. So that's still true, but what I have seen is a resurgence of populism in other sectors of society and in other parts of the economy, so that you have things like Reverend Barber's doing in North Carolina.
Right.
You have the campaign that Ben Jealous is running in Maryland for governor. You have you have what's happening in California, the challenges to Dianne Feinstein.
Yes.
So I think definitely we are seeing the stirrings of a populist rising. But you know, part of it is that they now have to be whereas after the 1890s, populism, when it sort of put all its bets on William Jennings Bryan and then crashed,
mm-hmm.
it then turned rancid and racist, and you know, and that kind of discredited it for a generation.
Yeah.
And so, partly it has to deal with that legacy. It has to demonstrate that although it's populist, which means essentially a majoritarian movement, a movement that aims for the good of most people and not for the good of just the people at the top or the people with the right credentials, you have to also show that you're doing that across racial lines and that you're inclusive.
Yes.
And so it's a different kind of populism, and often I find that its most able and persuasive advocates are black and brown activists, not the white rural activists who've always been there and who are there again, but who, fairly or not, have to cope with this history of populism as both a popular rising and also a movement that, when it's thwarted, turns racist.
Oof. Yeah, that's it's good to learn history, that's for sure. That's one thing I've learned is that people generally don't learn from history. You don't want, they erase it. But, well, that's another matter. And, you know, we're talking about an election coming up in November, and it's Democrat on one side, Republican on the other side. That's the usual split. But my sense is, and one thing Jim Hightower has talked about, is that it's really more top versus bottom than left versus right. And that could be a whole new arrangement, and you know, things could fall out differently. What's your sense of, are people getting that?
Well, my sense, first of all, I think it's always safe to begin by saying I agree with Jim Hightower, so I'll say that for the record.
Yeah.
I do think that the effect of 2016, not just Trump's election, but also Bernie's campaign and the Clinton car crash, was not just a pendulum swing, but did represent a wrecking ball to politics as usual. So I think, you know, we are in the midst of one of those generational realignments. And I suppose part of what's scary is that in the 60s you saw an attempt to have a generational realignment that was bottom-up and generated by and in response to very broad-based mass social movements, the movement for black freedom and the movement to end the war in Vietnam. You know, these were both movements that had very big bases all over the country. and you saw electoral politics in one way or another responding to them, whether it was the McGovern reforms to the Democratic Party or whether it was, you know, Richard Nixon's kind of trying to harness the reaction to them, and the sort of whole silent majority phenomenon. And what's scary about what's happening now is that there is this realignment, but you don't get the sense that the kind of electoral politics, there's not a kind of clear line of connection between, or a robust responsive connection between electoral politics and movement politics. So you have things like the Movement for Black Lives, you have Me Too, you have, you know, the Women's March, and you have, and I thought this was one of the most inspiring phenomena in American politics, you had all of those people turning up at airports and,
yes,
you know,
yes, that was great.
To thwart deportations and to tell immigrants that they're welcome here. You have
yes.
the sort of immigrant rights movement, which is happening in all sorts of places across the country, you know, even up here in rural Vermont. But there isn't a kind of clear mechanism connecting that to the kind of electoral choices we're offered. Instead, you have a kind of politics of resentment and fear stirred by Trump and being deployed expertly by Trump.
Yes.
And then you have these kind of Democrats who say, no, things aren't that bad, and you know, just give us a little bit of, you know, we're a slightly better version of what you've already had.
Right.
And that scares me because I really think that most people in the country understand that it's not working and that something has to change. And you know, unless the left offers real concrete proposals for change that people can get behind and organize around and mobilize for, if the only promise of change is the kind of endless parade of reflexive but captivating pronouncements by Donald Trump, then we're in trouble.
And we can't just be not Trump. People have to see something. There's this tremendous energy out there, and if we don't tap into it, yeah, I worry, which brings us back right to the beginning. So if people want to read your very interesting articles, what website can you point them to? The Nation, I assume?
I can point them to www.thenation.com. It's also available for those of you who like to read it in print. It's also available at a quality newsstand near you. Support your local newsstand.
All right. Well, I support my local bookstore, that's for sure. Hey, thanks so much. Look forward to talking again in the future, and let's hope for some good results. It can happen.
All right. Well, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, Bert.
Likewise, Don. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You ask me what I like about Texas. I tell you it's a wide open spaces. It's everything between the Sabine and the Rio Grande. It's a Llano Estacado. It's the Brazos and the Colorado. It's the spirit of the people who share this land. It's another burrito. It's a cold lone star in my hand. It's a quarter for the jukebox boys. Play the Sons of the Mother of the House Band. Well, you ask me what I like about Texas. It's the big timber around Nacogdoches. Driving El Camino Real down to San Antonio. It's the river walking the tierras, jamming out with Bongo Joe. The stories of the Menger Hotel and the Alamo. You remember the Alamo? It's another burrito. It's a cold lone star in my hand. It's a quarter. The jukebox boys play the Sons of the Mother.